Let's talk. John Brown.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
And nobody expects, well, nobody knows what to expect when my next guest comes on, because he's becoming a regular feature where we're not pontificating about the Crusader states or 20-sided dice or whatever else. But this time, ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys and whatever that is lurking in the corridor, I'm delighted to say that Jem is back with us. Jem, my worthy brother, my evil twin, my doppelganger, how the devil are you, sir?
Giles, hello. Great to be back as always.
How are the condensed histories going, by the way?
They're condensing. Yes? What can I say? I recently fell down a rabbit hole. The hottest thing on Netflix right now is K-pop Demon Hunters, and I've managed to do an episode on K-pop Demon Hunters. That's a thing.
Okay, let's not even we'll save that.
That's a whole other conversation.
Let's just save that. I even sent you over the Warhammer 4000 Baldric and Blackadder, which I thought you'd enjoy that one as well.
Thank you very much.
So, what are we looking at today, Jem? What is crossing the Jem radar, if you? What has been bleeping in the corner but heading towards the central axis?
Well, I thought we were sort of behind the scenes. Yep. Obviously, we started talking to each other because I write books, and I thought it might be interesting for your listeners to hear kind of like the bare truth, sort of like the naked reality that is the publishing world.
Right. Now, for those who don't know, you have done a few books in your... How many have you published now, Jem?
It gets complicated, about a dozen. But here's the thing. I've had some self-published products too, some books too. And also, I have ghostwritten a book as well, which obviously I can't tell you what that is because that defeats the purpose of something that's ghostwritten. So... I always describe myself as on the fringes of publishing because I don't have a literary agent and I have done self-publishing as well as publishing, if you like. So you're going to get the unvarnished reality from me.
Now, you see, the way I look at it, you see, you have your publishing houses, which, if you like, to go back to our early conversations, are your heavy cavalry, okay? They live by a chivalric code. They're thundering across the plains and the shock of the publishing day, and it spreads chaos and you get a bestseller. However, self-publishing, you're there, you're light cavalry, you've got your composite bow, and you're not engaging and you're just firing away, you know, on the social media, on your Patreon site, going, go on, check out my book there. Is that an analogy which you didn't think I was going to pull out, Jem? But there you go.
Yeah, do you know what? It's pretty good.
I like it.
It's gonna get more messy than that, but I think that's a great place for people to start thinking about. But actually, what I want to do as a sort of starting point is tell you about a job I used to have. So I used to work in the exhibition industry. I'm sure every listener here has at some point walked into a massive hall with loads of stands in it. The topic could be anything. It could be fishing. It could be pets. In this case, it was the London Book Fair. Now, I can say this because I'm only going to say good things about it, but it's the second largest publishing exhibition in the world. And so what you've got there is agents, publishers, and deals are being done for like international rights, etc., but also to show the market this is what's coming out from us.
Right.
And the thing is, and this is the reason why I'm starting here, is because just walking into the London Book Fair shows you the problem the publishing industry has and why any listener here is going to find it very, very hard to get published in any way, because I would walk into this hall. There are literally hundreds of publishers there, and each one, you know, you can't run a business publishing one book a year. So each one has a dozen or more books. So when you start multiplying that, you're talking about 10,000 or more books that are coming out, not in total, but just this year.
Right.
Nobody has the time to read all of them. Now, obviously, there are specialized sectors. For example, the kids sector. I noticed dinosaurs are always popular.
Yeah.
History sector. Nazis. Can't go wrong with Nazis.
Absolutely
and then
not.
With fiction, sexy stuff always does well. So I guess if you want to create the perfect bestseller, what you need to do is a book about sexy Nazi dinosaurs, and that might well sell. I don't know.
Ba-ching, as the saying.
Yeah. But you see, that the problem is, sort of being unflippant for a moment, nobody has time to read all those books. So these publishers are pumping out these books, and they know Most of them will fail. So first of all, they've got too many books. And then that's not including everybody who's come to them with a book. So my journey started, I was in that company, which included London Book Fair.
Right.
And by the way, only industry people can go to it. They're not going to allow the general public to go to London Book Fair because everyone's just going to walk up to the publisher going, will you read my manuscript? No.
Hello, I've written a book about the Letterjack Toad.
Thank you, Colin. It's a winner. So I was in this company. I would lunchtime talk with my mates about history, and they go, "Jem, you're really good at sort of like bringing history to life. You should write a book." So I did. I wrote something called The Busy Person's Guide to British History, which basically is an overview of British history from the Stone Age to 1945. And I went to some publishers with it. And what I got was really good advice saying, "This is too general. Nobody will buy it." And what they meant was, it's like, look, if this was linked to a TV show, if it was the BBC's Busy Person's Guide to British History, as seen on TV, that will sell. Or if it's linked to a celebrity, so if they gave it to George Clooney, and then it was George Clooney's Busy Person's Guide to British History, that would sell. But who are you, Jem? And nobody's going to buy a generalist book just because it's come out. So they said, hit something specific. We'll talk if you can write that. And that was my first published book, Deus Vult, A Concise History of the Crusades, as approved by Giles.
Absolutely. There you go. There's your celebrity name.
But that was specific. You know, we're homing into the Middle Ages. We're homing into a specific cultural movement. I'm not going to go into that. But the point is, that's what got me published. And it was Amberley, the guys who about 10 years later came to you about Devil's Horseman, which is just out. So I have had a
excellent
very long
book,
relationship
by the way, people
with...
go and buy it. Thank you, Archer.
Thank you. So I ended up self-publishing The Busy Person's Guide because I, you know, I'd written it, I put the effort in. But going to a publisher, gone.
Self-publisher. Okay, so you're not going to walk in there, they're going to go, "Thank goodness it's the book we've been looking for. Oh, thank you, Jem." Because that is what we, because that's the thing, you know, I mean, I know people who are writers, trust me on this one. And, you know, tend to rock, and they, you know, one of them went to all the big publishing houses. It's a bit like going with your C60 cassette of your band, isn't it, basically? I mean, there's millions of people thinking it's a book of art. Yeah.
It's exactly like that. Yeah. And the statistical chances are about the same. Now, on the history side of things, because you tend to be a specialist, you know, people frown when you make stuff up in history books, okay? So therefore, you have to have a certain expertise, and therefore there's far fewer of them, and therefore you can go to a non-fiction publisher and they will talk to you.
Yeah.
But part two of this is I'd done now like four books with Amberley. I had a really good working relationship with them, but I came up with an idea for a historical novel. So here's a pitch to you, Giles. Would you read this? So Silent Crossroads is the story of Harry Woods, who is the only British soldier to have fought in both world wars for both sides. So the first half of the book, there he is, 17-year-old in the trenches of World War One, British Tommy. He gets injured. He gets captured by the Germans. He then gets looked after by a German nurse who can speak English, and he falls in love.
Of course he falls in love.
So cutting a long story short, to get out of the British POW camp, he's willing to join the German forces, but he will only fight the French because he doesn't want to fight the Brits. And so after World War One, he then settles down, starts having a family. And so you start seeing the rise of Nazism through the eyes of a foreigner, through somebody and through the family that he's married into. Some of them like what they're hearing. Some of them are deeply suspicious. So really, it's a way of sort of showing you how Hitler lured in Germany into doing what it did. Does that sound like a good story?
You see, the thing is, Jem, my interest, one of my several, apart from the composite, the light composite bow, is the fact that my grandfather was a Rover Sergeant Major, was in the Army of the Rhine, spent a long time in Germany. I am fascinated by the Reich in a good way. Yeah, okay, so not in that sort of, because my bookshelf gets some very strange looks, I can assure you, when people come around, but about how, so yes, that would, for me, that is my, you know, anything that involves the rise to power of the National Socialist is always going to tick my boxes, Jem.
And so the reason why it's called Silent Crossroads is by the end of it, you know, we're at the end of World War II. He's back in the British Army. It's a whole thing. All right. It's a family drama, etc. But the reason why it's called Silent Crossroads is because throughout the book, he's making moral choices and you get to see the consequences of those moral choices by the end of the book.
Right.
So I went to, I put my heart and soul into this. I went. Oh, and here's the other thing. If you see a book and on the front of it, it's got, let's say, Stephen King. Yeah. Everybody assumes Stephen King's the only person who's seen that book until I pick it up. That is absolutely not how publishing works. So the saying in the industry is your first draft is to get it done. The subsequent draft is to get it right. So here's the thing. I write the books. I then pay an editor myself. She's amazing. She's literally just retired. You know, she then goes through the book and starts tearing it to pieces. She will, and please, if anybody's listening to this guy, I'm brilliant at English. I can edit myself.
I am an artist. This is my business, my work.
No, it doesn't work because you know what you're trying to say. You fail to miss the fact that you've left out an and in the sentence or a therefore later on because you're reading ahead. You're skipping bits. You need somebody who's never read this before to go in cold and to start tearing it to pieces in a constructive way.
Yeah.
So she has been involved with every single one of my published books, but she's also been involved in all of my self-published stuff too.
When I used to work as a journalist in London on magazines or whatever, I used to be a freelancer and I used to be brought in to do exactly that, and I was known as a tiller of the sub.
There we go. So the editor will have a look at it, but then once I present the manuscript to the publisher, they will have their own editors look at it because there's a house style.
Yeah.
It could be that, Jem, you're using too much fruity language here. We can't. That's not how we roll. Okay, fair enough. So basically, by the time you see a book by Stephen King or whoever, there's probably been four people who've really leaned hard into it. Now, admittedly, with the likes of J.K. Rowling or Stephen King, they're famous enough that they will probably tell the house editor to shut up because I'm the big dog. There may be an element of that. And certainly with the later Harry Potter books, when they're over 1,000 pages long for kids, clearly an editor needed to have got in there, but they were kept away. But anyway, so the point is, I had this thing ready to go with my publisher, this historical novel, and I went to Amberley, and they went, Jem, that's great. Thank you so much for this. Not our market. And I went, what? It's like, well, I give you all the books. We've got a relationship. And they went, no. It's a totally different market, the fiction market to the history or non-fiction market. We can't help you. We can't get this into a bookstore. You have to talk to totally different people to get this out.
Oops.
So you now need to speak to other publishers, and they are the ones who will not speak to the general public. You need representation. And this is where we get the term literary agent.
Ooh, go on then. I'm thinking somebody flouncing around with a lot of bohemian style things, you know.
Yeah, pretty much nailed that. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
And so here's the thing. Going back to that London Book Fair, you have 10,000 or more books produced every year, and that's just in English, by the way. So there are just too many books out there. So these literary agents, they represent writers, and it may be somebody. I mean, you would hate to be the literary agent of George R.R. Martin because, yeah, his books sell, but he only makes one every 10 years. You can't earn a living off of that. But then, secondly, they are just swamped with people going, I've written the Natterjack Toad one or whatever.
Yes.
And so they aren't looking for reasons to say yes. They're looking for reasons to say no. And they've got to follow the current trends as well. What's hot at the moment? It's like, if Alistair MacLean was to write a book today, he was a super hot thriller writer in the 60s and 70s. Yep. He couldn't get published today. That market has disappeared, okay? But, men today do not get their thrills out of reading books. They do it from watching action movies on video or on or video games.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's a whole market that's gone. So they have to be susceptible to what's hot at the moment, but also they're looking for reasons to say no because there's an awful lot of garbage coming in. And I then had to start announcing myself to these guys, and I had an advantage. Look, here are the books that have been published. I can hit deadlines.
Yeah.
They've sold well enough. The publisher wants me to work with them again. online, and I couldn't get anywhere. Using my business skills, you know, worked for London Book Fair, so I'm a business person by day, I managed to sit down with a literary agent. Now, I cannot stress how rare this is. Not a telephone call, not an email. I was in a room with one.
Good grief.
Should have brought handcuffs.
What are they like in? Do you approach them quietly? Do you not make any things? Do you, know?
You don't make a sudden move.
Exactly.
And bring coffee. Anyway, no, but the point is, I will never forget what she said. She said, "You can write. Good. You know, quality. I want to think I'm producing quality." And she said, "And this is a commercial idea. Excellent. I'd love to sell more than two of these copies." But she then added, "But I'm just not in love with it enough to take it any further." What? I mean, if you were able to add in sound effects, this would be the point where you do the needle scratch, you know? Whatever. And it's like, but I'm not asking you to marry it. I'm asking you to sell it. And if you think it can sell it,
have a consensual fling with it, Jem, at least, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. You can look back and remember it fondly that weekend in Paris, for example.
Exactly. So, look, I'm not going to go into this any further because I don't want to sort of like shame people or so anything. But the point is this. I get where they're coming from. I have empathy with these people because they are swamped with manuscripts, so they just don't know what's good and what's bad.
And I mean, they must be. I mean, after the Twiglets affair, otherwise known as Twilight, they must have had so many vampires crashing into the window, and then every sub Harry Potter you could possibly want as well. And they just go, "Come on, have an original idea," because you go to my like good morning to my local independent bookstore. You know who you are. And Alicia, and you go down to the young adult fiction. You can't move. Now, I've got nothing about having fantasies in there, trust me, but for a period there, this is how we are mates, mate. But you know, you go in there and everything was a wizard, and it was like, here we go, Harry, sub Harry Potter. So you got to have some sympathy with them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and the thing is, so if we go into self-publishing, it's the Wild West. You could write something on your phone this morning and have it up this afternoon. So there's total hot garbage there. But then also, perhaps the two famous, everyone loves using these two examples, the two book series or books that became so hot they ended up being made into Hollywood films is The Martian, you know, that one where Matt Damon's lost on Mars, and the 50 Shades of Grey, which actually started as fan fiction around the Twilight saga. So, I mean, there is no professional nutrients there, literary awesomeness there, but boy, did they sell by the truckload. Yeah. And that's the thing. You're J.K. Rowling, Stephen King, George R.R. Martin's. None of these people make most of their money from books. Mm. Books are really an ancillary. What everybody wants to do is get it turned into a TV show or a movie. When you look at Rowling, for example, she made just enough money from the first Harry Potter to get to do a second Harry Potter, but she was still financially very insecure. It's really by the time you get to the third Harry Potter where she gets a deal from Warner Brothers. That is when the millions start coming in, because she created this whole fantasy world, all of the merch, she gets a cut off. Now, I'm all for, she's a self-made woman. This is all inside her head. Brilliant for her. She deserves every penny she gets, but that's when she made the money.
Yeah.
If she managed to make all seven books and they were all loved by just 1,000 kids and everybody says, this is the best kept secret in the world, she would now be an accountant. Yeah. I don't know, in the local country, county council or something.
But it's interesting you say about A Song of Fire and Ice, otherwise known as Game of Thrones, because the problem with that is that he produces a book every 10 years, and it was such a roaring success on the actual as the TV series that they were running out of material, and that's why you can argue that Game of Thrones basically falls off a cliff. The first couple of series are absolutely brilliant, and the end is basically a West End musical.
The music, but yeah, exactly. I hear you on that, and when people argue who's better, George R.R. Martin or J.R.R. Tolkien,
I
think the best retort to that is Tolkien finished a story,
exactly,
and then mic drop at that point.
Yeah.
But this shows you that so basically, the literary agents are swamped, they're trying to second guess what trends the publishers are trying to follow. The publishers are trying to, and this thing, every time a book is launched, this could be the biggest thing ever, or it could go, nobody will buy it. It may be great, but nobody will buy it. And nobody knows until it goes out there. Mm. So I've got a friend, you know, again, not going to name names or anything like that, because I don't want to sort of get anybody in trouble. But they had a book that was selling quite well. They're through a pretty major publisher, and it was doing all right. But then it basically was written by two people. One of those people went on to TV, and then book sales started going up.
Yeah.
And it's that point the publisher started putting money behind it. You would think it's sort of like they will put money behind every book because they want every book to sell. They don't have enough money to do that, so they try and pick the winners. Or if something by accident catches fire, like my friend's book did, now we'll push money into that. And indeed, it got onto the bestseller list. So well done them. But that's the problem. If you're expecting your publisher to do lots of promotion for you, they're actually expecting, I mean, literally, I have been asked, how many Instagram followers do you have? How many Twitter followers do you have? Because they're hoping you can do it for them. Now, Ambly's a little bit different. Like I said, they literally have a PR department that got us in conversation, which is why we are now
indeed
talking about this.
Exactly.
Love Ambly.
Exactly. Hello, Ambly. Thank you much. Ambly, look what you've created.
Yes, but Ambly, they've got limited budgets, so you know they know they can't promote every single book they come out with. So going back to anybody listening going, but I've got a book inside me. You do you. You write. But the weird thing is, if you write your book, you need to be realistic about it. If you're a painter and you do it for therapeutic purposes, you don't think it's going to hang in the National Gallery in London, okay? Yeah. You know that's not going to happen. But pretty much everybody who writes a book kind of expects it to get published.
Absolutely.
And statistically, that's not going to happen. Also, the size of the prize. So here we go. Here's a quick game to play. Everybody, I know people don't like dead time on radio, but I'm going to pause for a second. But Here's the thing. I am spending £15. You buy one of my books for £15. How much of that do I get? So, you know, I've written the book, I've come up with the idea, but the publisher has to publish it and distribute it. Obviously, the local bookstore has to sell a bit of it. How much of that £15 do I get?
£2.
£2 we're going for. That's not a lot of money, is it, people? But it's less than that. It's 8%.
No.
It's £1.20. So I have to sell thousands of books.
The way you said thousands there, Jen, was worth it in the end.
Yeah, thousands of books to just cover my mortgage. I do not earn enough money from my books to earn a living. That's why I am a business person by day, a writer by night. I have monetized my hobby, and that's what 99.99999% of writers do. Yeah, people talk about Rowling or King or Martin. They are the exception to the rule. If you think about it, how many books are sell well, but they're from a famous person. So even they have another job you know about.
Danny Dyer's book on the 20th century avant-garde movie.
Exactly. Danny Dyer's Busy Person's Guide to British History. Exactly. I can give that to. And ironically, the book that I mentioned this briefly at the beginning, the book I made most money from is when I ghostwrote, because it's a job. I don't get my name on the front cover. So they paid me an upfront fee to do it.
Oh.
I get a little cut from the upfront fee to do it, upfront fee on completion, and then a little cut of it moving forward.
When you ghostwrote, did you actually meet the person, or were you given
absolutely
the role? Okay, and you
and
sat.
And to be fair, to the person I ghostwrote for, they recognized I did such a great job of pulling so much data together to turn it into a book. He said, "You really should be on the front cover." But the publisher turned around and went, "Sorry, no, we're paying you to be a ghostwriter." So hey ho, that's the way it goes.
So
I won't do it again, but it did pay.
Yeah, well, therefore, you've got to make, you know, this, when somebody used to say to me, what sort of writer do you want to be? Or, you know, when I was trying to be an actor, what sort of actor do you want to be? I want to be a working one. I don't want to be Shakespeare. I want to be one who actually works. And I once had a woman came up to me once, a very beautiful young lady who I ended up going out with for a while. And she was a writer as well. And she said, I hear you're Giles Brown. I'm a writer, but I'm not like you. I'm a proper writer. Cause I mean, she said, I was like, listen, I have written for the Times, the whatever, da 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 da. You know, and so therefore there is this whole strata, isn't there, of I'm going to go away and fill my pockets full of stones like a la Virginia Woolf and wander into the Thames. It's like, just get the bloody thing written, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, on that point, you know, because I've written books, that's led to some of the history magazines saying to me, could you write a version of that in 2000 words? Or, you know, I do sometimes paid for history talks online. So, yeah, I'll be honest with you, probably over a year, I earn maybe £1,200 to £1,400. So that's enough for a family away in the Cotswolds for a week in a self-catering cottage. Thank you, publishing industry. But no, that's not a career.
Right then. So I'm going to run out of time, as we always do, Jane, because I've got to put an ad break in before we finish. I just had a thought. So what we've basically... it was dinosaurs, sexy and Nazis, yeah? So I've come up with 50 shades of fascist velociraptor. What do you think?
Yes, yes.
We could do T-Rex, but they wouldn't be able to get their hands around each other because obviously they haven't got long enough arms.
That's a seller to be sure. But being aware of, like, you know, oh, it would be great if this stuff was turned into a movie. So do I have 1 minute?
You got 1 minute. Go off you go.
1 minute. Okay, fine. So I did some research on the Vietnam War. I was going to turn it into a history book. Didn't work. So I turned it into a novel about a guy then in 1960s jungle and today as an old man going back to Vietnam with his granddaughter. So, you know, clash of the generations. It's called Echoes. I wrote it up. I knew it wasn't going to get published, so I self-published it. But using my business skills, I always thought if this was turned into a movie, the old guy could be Sylvester Stallone, sort of saying goodbye to his Rambo persona like Clint Eastwood did to his cowboys in Unforgiven. So I managed to get a copy of that book to Stallone's house. I don't know if he ever read it. I never heard anything about, but I'm so proud that my book Echoes, if you want to know about, like, Vietnam, it's got real facts in it, but also it's a good story.
That's
Echoes.
That's my second history specialist subject. You so-and-so. Right, we're going to talk Vietnam next time. Right, that's the next one done. Absolutely believe it. Where can people... Jem, we got 10 seconds. Where can people find you online?
I'm at Jem Deducci on X and Blue Sky and Condensed Histories podcast.